U.S. President Donald Trump talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky about peace.
I just spoke to President Zelensky of Ukraine. The conversation went very well. He, like President Putin, wants to make peace.
Blunt talk to NATO from the U.S. Defense Secretary about Ukraine.
As the war approaches its third anniversary, our message is clear. The bloodshed must stop, and this war must end.
An analysis of the new U.S. administration's position on the Russian invasion and ending the war it started.
Hegseth, I think that was the most surprising to some people. And he just, he certainly threw cold water on any who retained illusions that Trump is not going to break things, is not marking a sharp departure.
Today is Wednesday, February 12th, and this is The Issue from VOA. I'm Scott Walterman.
As you know, this morning, the president spoke to President Putin of Russia. They spoke at length.
White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt briefing reporters on U.S. President Trump's efforts to start peace talks between Russia and Ukraine.
The president just recently got off the phone with President Zelensky of Ukraine. His truth is as follows. I just spoke to President Zelensky of Ukraine. The conversation went very well. He, like President Putin, wants to make peace. We discussed a variety of topics having to do with the war, but mostly the meeting that is being set up on Friday in Munich, where Vice President J.D. Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio will lead the delegation. I am hopeful that the results of that meeting will be positive. It is time to stop this ridiculous war, where there has been massive and totally unnecessary death and destruction. God bless the people of Russia and Ukraine.
Also on Wednesday, U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth made his first appearance at NATO, where he also addressed Russia's war in Ukraine.
We want, like you, a sovereign and prosperous Ukraine. But we must start by recognizing that returning to Ukraine's pre-2014 borders is an unrealistic objective.
Speaking at a meeting of Ukraine's military allies at NATO headquarters in Brussels, Hegseth delivered the clearest and most blunt public statement so far on the new U.S. administration's approach to the nearly three-year-old war.
A durable peace for Ukraine must include robust security guarantees to ensure that the war will not begin again. This must not be Minsk 3.0. That said, the United States does not believe that NATO membership for Ukraine is a realistic outcome of a negotiated settlement. Instead, any security guarantee must be backed by capable European and non-European troops. If these troops are deployed as peacekeepers to Ukraine at any point, they should be deployed as part of a non-NATO mission, and they should not be covered under Article 5.
Let's dig into this and try to get some perspective. Joining us now is Robert David English, a professor at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. His specialty, international foreign policy and defense analysis, regional studies, Russia, the former USSR, and Eastern Europe. Thank you so much for being able to join us.
Glad to do it.
All right. So a lot of news today. U.S. Secretary Hegseth went to NATO and pretty much gave us our clearest vision of U.S. policy now towards Ukraine and Russia in the new administration. And then President Trump had a phone call with both President Putin and President Zelensky. So big picture thoughts.
The big picture, I think, for me, and I guess the big picture is that Hegseth, I think that was the most surprising to some people. And he just, he certainly threw cold water on any who retained illusions that Trump is not going to break things, is not marking a sharp departure. You know, we've seen over the last few weeks some hopeful articles that said, you know, Trump seems to be changing his tune on Ukraine. People jumped on every critical comment he might have made about Putin, or Steve Bannon said something that Trump must be careful or Ukraine could become his Vietnam. And all that added up to a lot of people in the establishment saying, oh, maybe he's not going to be, you know, so tough on Ukraine. There won't be a sharp break. Well, there will. There is. And Hegseth laid it out pretty clearly. We know that aid will not be forthcoming as it has in the past. He's made it clear that there will be a major land swap. I mean, that the line of combat will probably be where things end up, and illusions of a Ukrainian victory or even large reclaiming of territory will be that illusory. And maybe most importantly, that the U.S. will not be participating in peacekeeping. The Europeans have to do this. And what's more, they're going to pay for it, right? This is all accompanied by this demand that the Europeans increase their defense spending. They don't just have to meet the 2% target. Now Trump says it's 5%. And along the way, he said, by the way, you need to buy our weapons with a lot of that money, and it's going to be a business deal. So all this is hitting at once, and I think there are no more illusions, right? There, we thought maybe, some hoped, but he's made it clear. And this statement was definitive. It was prepared. There's no confusing it or misinterpreting.
Well, that is the foundational administration's policy of America first, is it not, in practice?
It is, and we were warned, and we've heard pieces of this. But again, those who are the strongest Ukrainian backers, who've sometimes tended to, you know, be overly hopeful, a little bit of cheerleading, rose-colored glasses, have now had all that stripped away. And this is the reality we're going to have to deal with. We saw it coming. We kind of knew. It's now just been spelled out more starkly than ever. And it's moving forward because Trump has started having these conversations with Putin. And this prisoner exchange that was just announced is a kind of a piece of that. Trump said it shows hopeful progress, and he sees it as part of a resumption of talks that will lead to a Ukraine settlement. So it's underway, and there's not going to be any arguing Hegseth or Trump or Kellogg back from these core positions they've taken. The Europeans are going to have to do the heavy lifting. America wants to profit from it.
Yeah, there's a deal, or there's some talk of a deal of U.S. weapons to Ukraine for minerals from Ukraine back.
Yeah, that there's a lot of confusion about that, because at one point, if you recall, right, we are drinking from a fire hose. This was only a few months ago, but it seems like ancient history. When Zelensky announced late last fall what he called his victory plan, and he came to Washington and he presented it at the EU and Brussels as well, he put on the table in a big way for the first time a kind of bargaining chip. He said, we can offer access to deals, to participation, to joint ventures to develop our oil and gas and rare earth elements, all kinds of minerals, in return for continued support. Zelensky put that out there, and we all kind of assumed if it came to pass, it would be sort of for the future, right? We want continued Western aid, and we're going to help pay for it in this fashion. And leaving aside a lot of legal complications in Ukraine, now Trump has turned it around and said, no, we want to be paid back for what we've already given you. He literally said that the other day. Now, we don't know how definitive it is, but he said, we want to be paid back. So Trump is saying, we want access to those minerals. And he's talking about hundreds of billions in deals. And we want that access. We want that profit, at least in part, to pay for what we've already given you, much less going forward. So this is all happening. You know, as I said, we're drinking from a fire hose. Most things are a little murky. But again, Hegseth made one thing clear. The Europeans have to pay more. The Europeans have to pick up the burden. The U.S. will focus its defense strategy on China.
Yeah, that's exactly what he said. He said there should be international peacekeepers, not NATO forces per se, even though they're coming largely from NATO nations. But the U.S. will not put troops on the ground in Ukraine. Europe's going to have to do that. And Europe's going to have to pay for the defense. Again, not NATO countries per se, even though they're all NATO countries. And Ukraine is not getting into NATO, at least not now.
Yeah. So again, cold water all around. And we should have seen this coming. Of course, there's always hope that some of what Trump says is bombast, is exaggerated. But on the core elements, we knew this was coming. It was pretty clear from statements of his own and from his, you know, his allies, his aides over the last 6 months. They've just made it concrete now. And so we go forward. But the hardest, you know, adjustment, of course, will come for Zelensky and the Ukrainians. And you saw the, if you saw the press conference at the NATO support group, right, you saw Hegseth, his 7-minute speech, and you saw two seats over the Ukrainian defense minister looking so uncomfortable. This was most shocking for the Ukrainians because everything Zelensky's been saying and promising, it was only a day or two ago he gave an interview to The Guardian, right? That's where he laid out. He said, we will not accept anything but NATO membership and ultimate NATO membership. And in the meantime, they have to be Western, including American boots on the ground. He spoke so definitively as if he could set the terms. And those were the terms he set. That, and he said it could take up to 150, maybe even 200,000 peacekeepers. After all, there is a 1,000-kilometer, you know, line of contact between the Russian-held force, the Russian territory and Ukrainian, Russian-held territory and Ukrainian-held territory. So up to 200,000 peacekeepers. Where is Europe going to get that? Even half of that, they can't even find enough for a brigade in Lithuania or some new deployment elsewhere. And now they're going to have 50, 75, 100,000 or more? Well, maybe Zelensky was, you know, exaggerating the number needed for his own purposes. But there's just shock at the cost and responsibility of all of this, and that the U.S. will not be contributing very much at all.
Yeah, It is happening so fast because I saw Zelensky put up on social media that he spoke to Trump and the talk went well and, you know, he spun it positively. And then I saw a comment by the British defense minister who said, you know, the terms are up to Ukraine and it's up to Ukraine when and how to start the peace process. And I thought that was a little out of sync with what we heard today from Ukraine and the United States. And, you know, Putin hasn't commented, but I assume he's happy with the way things went.
Yep. I agree completely. And again, in Moscow, we have the prisoner exchange and the return of this convicted money launderer for an arrested, illegally detained, as they say, wrongfully detained American school teacher, another charge of a tiny marijuana possession. And so, you know, they're celebrating how great a deal they struck with Trump, while Trump is trying to put the best face on what looks like not the best deal, you know, a small petty charge up against a major international financial criminal. But I think the Trump team is pretty confident that they dominate the media, that they don't worry about the political fallout that Biden might have worried about when he made a prisoner exchange and had to be so careful that it looked roughly equal and was still savaged by conservative critics. Trump doesn't worry about that. He'll spin it and it'll be over in a day because the next story will come along. And so he can strike these deals and you know, gain some favor with on the Russian side. And again, he says this is momentum towards a peace deal. But what many of us are watching for is who's really giving up more, who's getting the better deal, not just on the prisoners, but on the fate of Ukraine. And right now, it looks really, really difficult. And it's not going to be a good deal for Ukraine. I would just add, I reemphasize the question of how fast it's moving, because we've been used to in Washington, in Brussels, the slow pace of this and discussing alternative plans while another shipment of arms helps Ukraine stay in the fight. And we're looking 6 months, 9 months, a year down the road. And now it's speeding up and it could be a matter of just a couple of months and something is being hammered out. And what's being hammered now looks a lot weaker and a lot worse for Ukraine than many of us had hoped.
It looks like a good deal for Putin, right? He gets to keep a substantial part, if not all of the land they now occupy, we presume. He saves face. They walk away. because it's been an expensive war for them. Ukraine gets out of the war. They don't get what they wanted, but at least the war ends, presumably, if this thing goes forward.
Yeah, there has long been an argument, and not only in the West, but by some Ukrainians, saying that, look, we may be better off just saying goodbye to Crimea and not fostering hope of ever regaining it, and also to the kind of more old Rust Belt, ethnically heavily Russian parts of eastern Ukraine, much of the Donbas, and moving forward with rapid development, make the rest of Ukraine prosperous, European modern, get into the European 100%, get that foreign investment. Right now, we keep fighting for this territory that, even if we somehow won it back, would be a sinkhole of trillions. Let the Russians have this cratered, polluted mess. Let's get on with it. We've seen more Ukrainians gently, quietly saying that just because the cost has been so high. So now that will be foisted on them. Now that option is going to become a reality. And the question will be, how fast can they, you know, once the deal is done, there'll be political fallout. Zelensky will probably be gone soon in any elections. You know, charges of corruption, mistakes in the war, and just general tiredness because he's been in power for so long. And now the things he promised won't be delivered, victory. So he'll be gone and there'll be political bloodletting in Ukraine. But then the rebuilding will commence. And that's where these hopes come into play. How fast and how successful can the 80% of Ukrainian territory be resurrected as a European, vibrant, democratic market economy? And, you know, the Bosnians or the Serbs, we see so many cases of territory lost after the Yugoslav civil wars or after the secession of Kosovo from Serbia, where sometimes it works in that rosy way I described. And then people don't nurse this grudge and they move forward with a new Ukraine, slightly smaller, but a lot more prosperous. Or you have a country like Serbia, which is, on the contrary, still nursing, still unhealed wound of the Kosovo secession, paralyzing domestic politics in Serbia, helping the nationalist right stay in power, and, you know, keeping the country back from really joining Europe and the EU. Which will it be for Ukraine? That's where I'm kind of focused now, because I am kind of trying to be a realist and say, well, whatever I think of the Trump approach, whatever I think of the Biden and the NATO approach of the preceding 3 years, this is now what's happening. Let's, you know, do the best we can out of it. And not the my experience from covering Central Europe and living and traveling and researching there makes me very wary of the trap of getting stuck in the past and instead focused on do the best we can with what's left. And Ukraine can be a European country in every positive sense.
It's funny that you say that because I went out on Inauguration Day. I was on the Mall. Even though there was nothing going on, there were a lot of people out there who, you know, had come for the inauguration ceremony. And I ran into a man from Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, I want the war to be over. I think Trump's going to end the war. We just need to get on with it. So it's so weird that you say that because I hadn't thought about it till now. But that's exactly what he said.
Yeah. And, you know, it's not just realism and resigning oneself to making the best one can with what's left. It's also a recognition. I made allusion before to a sinkhole, you know, to somehow, even if it were possible, to triumph and retake large parts of not just Crimea, but the Donetsk, the Donbas. That would not only be a financial sinkhole for decades to come. It would also be the center of corruption, of contraband, of, you know, that porous border with Russia. It will always be politically unstable. There are so many reasons that even in 2021, but certainly now in 2024, 2025, that it's just not the same territory it was, not the same people, not the same industry, not the same infrastructure. And it not only promises to be an economic black hole, but a political one as well. And I think a lot of Ukrainians are recognizing that. They simply lived without it de facto for so long that they are moving ahead in a sense with central and western Ukraine. And they have been with all the damage of war, all the, you know, destruction of power plants and the grid. They've also been rebuilding and investing and, you know, establishing their own arms industry and their own oil and gas industry. And there has been progress, and there is a foundation for moving forward rapidly with sufficient Western support. But this turns us to maybe what's the real issue, which is that Western support. It's not coming from the U.S. in large amounts, at least not for the next 4 years. So it has to come from Europe, and Europe's resources are severely limited. We have elections coming up in Germany where the far right is gaining more and more power, and we know it's essentially on the basis of the economy, of the recession Germany's been in since this war began. It's not just the weapons and the economic aid they're sending to Ukraine, but it's the much higher energy prices everyone's paying. And there just isn't enough money and political patience on the part of the European populace for this to keep going on. And it's almost as if they have to choose between, are we going to keep funding this war, or are we going to save that money for rebuilding the Ukraine that's left? I'm putting it in kind of a strange, stark either or, but I think it kind of comes down to that. And when you look at the debates and public opinion, and I don't only mean in Germany, France, and Italy, but also in the Czech Republic, Poland, Slovakia, here, I'll put it starkly. The things that Viktor Orban was saying a year ago that provoked such outrage in Brussels, in the sort of centrist moderate part of Europe, are now coming true, at least in part, right? He said he went to Moscow. He said, we have to stop this war. He broke ranks with the other EU powers in even going to see Putin in Russia. And the idea of a sort of a ceasefire and freezing the conflict where it is and moving forward. Well, that's what's happening. And now Orban can go around and crow and say, I was right. I was just ahead of you all. And that's part of this sort of right-wing turn, this sort of nationalist make Hungary great again, or make Germany a kind of a MAGA variant in each European country. And I emphasize that because that will undermine the ability for the EU and NATO to do much of anything that requires a major new financial commitment.
It is a super attractive message.
Yeah.
For the populations of the world.
Yeah. And
that have been ravaged by, you know, pandemic, inflation, recession.
Pandemic, especially the Central European countries in particular, were on a path to sort of better prosperity, more rapid development, kind of closing the gap with the Germanys and Frances of Western Europe. And now they've stalled. Ever since the pandemic, they have been in a simmering political crisis. We look at the right wing in Poland, the Peace Party. We look at Orban and Fidesz in Hungary and others, and we focus on sort of a populist nationalist leader. But there are grounds for that kind of support because of this simmering political economic crisis. There's just a sense that the EU isn't working for us. And now that is, this war isn't working for us. They look at Brussels and say, you know, Stoltenberg, you promised victory. Ursula von der Leyen, you said Russia was collapsing. Those leaders, the NATO and EU leaders, have lost a lot of credibility. And that adds to the credibility, or the presumed credibility, of the rising right wing in these countries. And universally, they want to end the war. They don't worry about Russia. In fact, many of them would like to resume energy trade with Russia. So if that's where things are headed, you know, Trump's got a point. Make the best deal you can now, because our solidarity will only weaken.
Thank you so much for all of the insight you gave us.
You're welcome. I'm sorry it's not happy insight, but it's realistic.
I think it's reality. I think we're in a transactional world now.
Yeah.
Robert David English, a professor at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. This has been The Issue from The Voice of America. You can get news 24/7 from VOA. Just go to our website. It's voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.